This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 28th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Rylan and welcome to The Recap, bringing you some of the very best highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, our coverage of the Airbus A320 crash in the French Alps this week that gripped much of the world's media as the story unfolded surrounding the cause of the disaster. Also ahead on the program,
Russian missiles are indeed aimed at potential targets. And if they think that NATO is a potential target, then theoretically their missiles are trained to fly off in that direction.
We reflect on what might be described as a thawing Cold War in a highlight from The Briefing. And also to come,
there's an awful lot of people in an awful lot of other countries who are starting to, or have started, to shrug and say, this isn't our problem. And so the question is can the situation be improved fast enough such that you can actually withdraw resources without sacrificing the security?
We hear from Wednesday's edition of Midori House when our guests reflect on Ashraf Ghani's first official visit to the US in his role as Afghanistan's president. All that and much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Ben Rylan. The crisis in Yemen has been making news for all too long as governance in the country crumbles and the state becomes ever more incoherent. This week ended with news that President Hadi had taken refuge in Saudi Arabia after that country and a coalition of states launched airstrikes against Houthi rebels in Yemen. But even at the start of this week, the country was in a clearly deepening crisis. Last weekend saw US troops pull from the country and the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting. By Monday, Houthi rebels had seized Yemen's third largest city, Taiz. On The Globalist that day, Dominic Reynolds was joined by Iona Craig, a journalist with a lot of experience in the country.
It's significant strategically, really, because it's between Aden, which is where President Hadi is now stationed, and Sana'a, where the Houthis have been, where they really took control in September. So it looks like a step forward to the Houthis getting closer and closer to Aden and threatening Aden itself and southern Yemen. And Taiz is quite crucial in that passage if they're going to push further south.
So it's the latest sort of step in something that could lead them to Aden and Hadi. And explain to us exactly the role that he's effectively an exiled leader, Hadi, now at this point.
He wouldn't view it that way, but yes, he had to flee house arrest in Sana'a and snuck out from his house in the capital and fled to Aden. He has set up down there. He has got his own militias that he has been recruiting over several months now, really. I mean, they were popular committees that already existed and the government was paying, but now they're his sort of loyal militia, if you like. And he's been trying to consolidate power in Aden, and then there was battle for the control of the airport, for example, last week. And he is trying to therefore assert his authority over the country from Aden now while the Houthis are in control in Sana'a.
And putting it in perspective then, the Houthis broadly derive from the northern part of the country and they're sort of now moving south. And some suggestion that the former leader who was toppled in 2011 is supporting them.
Yes, absolutely. And I don't think there's any doubt about that fact that Saleh is supporting them. They wouldn't have been able to do what they've done without that. And we saw that quite clearly in events over the last few days with Hadi trying to remove commanders that were in military units and bases that were still loyal to Ali Abdullah Saleh with commanders that were loyal to him and the fighting that ensued as a result of that. That happened in Aden as well as in Lahij, which is where the American troops were. Where they were based in Lahij, that was still under the control or loyal to Ali Abdullah Saleh, and then the issues arose when the command change tried to happen.
I mean, really strong words coming out from the UN Special Envoy this weekend. who sort of reported to the Security Council about the situation and said, as I suggested in the introduction there, about a civil war being not too far away, potentially. You also use this powerful phrase saying it feasibly could become an Iraq/Libya/Syria combination. I mean, talk about trying to sort of shake people awake. Unpack that for us. Why is this potentially such a tinderbox?
It's a tinderbox because you've got so many different factions involved. At the top, it's almost a fight between two presidents. So again, between Ali Abdullah Saleh slash the Houthis and President Hadi. But underneath all of that brings in, now we've got the possibility of sectarian conflict being brought into that, particularly after the attacks against the Houthis in the mosques last week. People with a vested interest in dragging this into a sectarian war, which makes it similar to what happened in Iraq. And then you've got Sunni tribes that are now trying to fight the Houthis, anti-Houthi militias. You've got the southern secessionist issue, where you've got militiamen who are at the moment loyal to Hadi, but their main reason for fighting is to fight what they see as Ali Abdullah Saleh's men in disguise as the Houthis. So you've got so many multiple factions that makes it incredibly complicated, similar to a Syria scenario where you've got lots of different groups fighting for different reasons, that makes it, yes, if that all kicks off at the same time, which it already is really, then you're in a very dangerous and complicated situation.
That was Dominic Reynolds on Monday's edition of The Globalist, talking to the journalist Iona Craig. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Rylan. Now to hear from Monday's edition of The Briefing, where we discussed the rising stakes in Russia over the weekend in what could be described as a thawing Cold War. Russia's ambassador to Denmark, Mikhail Vanen, threatened to aim nuclear warheads at Danish ships if that country carried through its plan to join the NATO Shield missile defence system. So we asked, are we set for a nuclear apocalypse? And why aim said nukes at a ship? Robert Bound was joined in the studio by Michael Binion, lead writer for The Times of London and the paper's former Moscow correspondent.
Russian missiles are indeed aimed at potential targets. And if they think that NATO is a potential target, then theoretically their missiles are trained to fly off in that direction. But it is pretty theoretical. I mean, Russia is not going to start unleashing missiles at a warship simply because it's using a radar that's part of the NATO defensive shield. It's all part of the propaganda exercise and attempts by Russian politicians to intimidate NATO into not deploying this defensive shield, which they see as aimed at Russia.
And on the other side of the spectrum, or on the other side of the playing field, on the other team, if you will, is it a great sort of feather in NATO's cap to have Denmark wanting to be part of this thing? Is this also being ratcheted up? Is this a bit of propaganda from the Western side?
I wouldn't say it's being ratcheted up, but the NATO forces clearly need the support of their Nordic members, and particularly at a time where Russia is actually threatening a lot of Nordic installations. There are flypasts or flyovers or a lot of rather close incidents, particularly submarines in northern waters. And Danes have always been enthusiastic members of NATO. They're not going to themselves deploy missiles or any part of this nuclear shield that NATO is attempting to set up. But the fact that they will have radar installations on their warships, certainly it contributes, and it shows solidarity. And this is important at a time when NATO generally needs to show solidarity in the face of Russian threats over Ukraine.
In terms of the threat, in terms of this, you know, this idea of this material threat, what do the Russians have to throw at it in that theatre, in that Baltic theatre?
Well, there's been a long row about what this missile shield really is right from the start. It was originally set up not to protect NATO from Russia, although that has been the founding principle on which NATO was based. It was set up to stop rogue missiles coming from places such as Iran into Western Europe. And of course, you need a defensive shield on the perimeter of NATO to detect incoming missiles. The Russians saw it as something aimed directly at them. They thought that this is part of NATO's forward deployment to threaten Russia itself. And so there has been a long, long diplomatic argument and threats and counter-threats, and this has been going on for some time, and it looked as though the Russians had more or less tacitly accepted the fact that NATO would put this thing up and that it wasn't aimed at them. Well, now in their new mood, which is much more nervy, much more jumpy, and much more hostile to everything NATO does, they have again come back and seen this as something that's a threat to them, and in turn threatened everyone who is taking part.
And this, the missile defence ring, is simply that. It is something. It is an ongoing thing that everybody knows on both sides is something that needs to be strengthened, or that there is always the desire for it to be strengthened on NATO's side. So this spat that has happened over them at the moment is simply a fresh Russian reaction, or it is an ill-tempered Russian reaction to something they knew was going to happen.
Yes, I mean, the Russians know perfectly well that the West is committed to setting up this shield. They've been told many, many times it's not directed at Moscow. It's to stop rogue missiles coming in from places such as Iran or, who knows, ISIS or any of these terrorist groups in the Middle East. But nevertheless, they still now see it as potentially a threat to their own security. Now, at the moment, the atmosphere between NATO and Russia is very poor, and this is all because of Ukraine, as well as general suspicion on both sides. But the Ukrainian crisis has ratcheted up the tension, and so it's not surprising that various ambassadors in various NATO countries are going to sound off in what looks like a rather more aggressive posture.
That was Monocle's Robert Bound talking to Michael Binion in a highlight from Monday's edition of The Briefing. Now, from one aviation story to another that shocked much of the media this week in Europe and beyond. On Tuesday, one story came to dominate the news here, the crash of a Germanwings Airbus in the French Alps. The plane en route from Barcelona to Dusseldorf had 150 people on board, and the crash left no survivors. By now, we know much more about the disaster, as we'll hear later in this edition of The Recap. But on that night's edition of the Monocle Daily, as the world and its media tried to make sense of the story, Andrew Muller caught up with our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé on the line from Paris, and our transport editor Tristan McAllister, who joined from our New York bureau. Together, they assessed the scale of the story.
If there were to be something that is wrong with this jet that caused this, that, say, is standard across a fleet, the ramifications, the implications could be huge. So lots of concern tonight over just exactly what happened and trying to figure out how it happened so that it doesn't happen again, and to really bolster the long-held belief that this is a very safe airplane.
Tyler, to come back to you on that point, the A320 is, of course, as Tristan was saying, a very safe aircraft. Lufthansa are a byword for safety and well-run and well-managed airline. This is a crash that doesn't sound like the sort of thing that does happen. Does this kind of thing dramatically affect the confidence of current and potential passengers, do you think?
I think it does. It's happening very much in real time. And I was at a meeting in Zurich today and witnessed firsthand a lot of people just probably opting not to fly. And I'll put my hand up as one of them. I just was staring at, you know, an aircraft owned by the Lufthansa Group, an A320. And there was something I just felt, you know, I didn't feel like flying this afternoon. And partly going back to what Tristan's saying, we don't really know what happens. And it may be not the most politically correct thing to say, it may not be the most fashionable thing to say, but I think we were alluding to it in our intro. It's just, you know, a European aircraft also flown by German pilots, it's just simply not supposed to happen. And I think that has absolutely rattled a lot of people, even though some might say, oh, do I feel a little bit safer, you know, because I'm actually flying on the full cost sibling of the airline? Probably not. You know, this is very much firmly a subsidiary, you know, 100% owned and operated by Lufthansa. Lufthansa pilots, or at least former Lufthansa pilots, okay, under a new contract, albeit. But this is, you know, very much part of also Germany Incorporated. And I think that is what has rattled a number of people. I mean, not just number, I think scores. I was on a train to Paris this evening. I spoke to the woman at the Swiss railway office, and she said, I don't know what is going on today, but she said everybody is taking the train to Paris. And so that was, you know, it was a clear indication that people simply didn't want to fly today.
And Tristan, to come back to you, that detail that Lufthansa said they cancelled 7 Germanwings flights today flying out of Dusseldorf because crew members, for one reason or another, didn't want to get back on the planes. Is that kind of reaction common among airline staff whose airline has suffered a disaster like this? And what kind of allowances do airlines make for it?
I think it's case by case. You know, we've had incidents here in the U.S., in particular with United Airlines, where flight attendants just saw something, you know, funny scribbled in the dirt that was on the tail of an aircraft, just an ominous sort of smiley face, and they didn't want to fly, and the airline, you know, was forced to let them not fly. I'm sure there was a lawsuit that ensued and there were issues around it. But still, I mean, this is very sensitive territory, especially this year in particular. This has been happening, it seems, with more frequency than it should. And of course, people are on edge still. You know, I think it really comes down to the carrier's prerogative. If flight attendants aren't comfortable with flying, and nor do they feel like they can do their duty, I, as someone managing a brand, wouldn't want those flight attendants on the flight. So I think it's a very fair thing for them to cancel flights or to sort of scale things back as crew, as people sort of react to this, especially as we talk about the idea that this really doesn't happen with a carrier like Lufthansa, like a subsidiary Germanwings. You know, it really is about shock here, and I think that's what we're seeing.
That was our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé and our transport editor Tristan McAllister talking to Andrew Muller on Tuesday's edition of The Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Recap. Up next, Ashraf Ghani's first visit to Washington, D.C.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted here at Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. On Wednesday, Washington, D.C. hosted the first official visit to the U.S. by Ashraf Ghani as president of Afghanistan. By the time of that evening's Midori House here on Monocle 24, the trip had yielded at least one concrete result, a slowing of America's planned withdrawal of combat troops. And notably, President Ghani seemed at pains to thank America's troops and taxpayers for the sacrifices they've made for his country since 2001. On Midori House that day, Andrew Muller discussed the visit with Xenia Wickett, project director of the US project at Chatham House, and Oscar Gariola Rivera, senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University.
Clearly, the current Afghan president is trying to change the tone and produce a contrast with his predecessor. But perhaps the question here is not so much whether the Afghans can live without the Americans. Apparently not, but whether the Americans can live without the Afghans and leave Afghanistan. The problem here is whether America will have to continue over the year that Obama has said it will continue. This is the longest war in American modern history, and the result has not been further stability and the strength of the Afghani government. We're being told now that in 1 year, we will have a strong enough Afghan army. The Americans haven't been able to do so in almost a decade, the decade that they have been there. Why are they going to do so in 1 year?
All of which is true. It's been a very long, very difficult and very expensive war. It's a long time myself since I was in Afghanistan. I was last there, I think, 2003, but before that I'd been there in 1998. I would consider myself 2003 an improvement on what had been the case 5 years previously. But President Ghani, I think myself was being possibly somewhat optimistic when he also in his speech framed Afghanistan as part of a new Middle East, as he put it, that rejects extremism and intolerance. This from the president of a country in whose capital just last week a woman was beaten to death for apparently not even setting fire to a book of which other copies were at any rate available. Is he being untowardly optimistic, or is that just part of his job?
I think at some level that's part of his job. What leader in power do you know anywhere around the world lays out the, you know what, life is pretty awful and it's only going to get worse. It's not going to keep you in power for terribly long. So, I mean, I think it is part of his job. But, I mean, it's more than just a kind of communication strategy. I mean, he has been elected to make the situation better for Afghanistan and Afghans, plural, the population. the challenge is going to be, and this is the challenge that we've seen for over a decade now, which is there's an awful lot of people in an awful lot of other countries who are starting to, or have started to shrug and say, this isn't our problem. And so the question is can the situation be improved fast enough such that you can actually withdraw resources without sacrificing the security? And that's effectively the calculation that President Obama has been making for the last 6 years and will continue to make for the next 2 years. What he announced some years ago was a withdrawal of American forces such that all troops were leaving by the end of 2016. He is keeping to that all troops withdrawing by the end of 2016. What he's saying is we recognize there has to be a few more this year in order to be in a good place next year. Whether he can keep to that or not is a very big question. There was a letter from a number of senior Republican and Democratic figures, policymakers, former policymakers, an open letter that came out, I think it was yesterday or today, that essentially said, this is a good thing. More is needed. We do need to continue to engage in the security challenges in Afghanistan, and we may need to for quite a while. Whether the American people and the American politicians have the patience for that is a different matter entirely.
That was Andrew Muller on Midori House talking to Xenia Wickett and Oscar Gariola Rivera. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Now to Thursday morning's edition of The Globalist, where we took a look at the relationship between Washington and Jerusalem, which appears to be at an all-time low. After his stirring of the diplomatic pot in Washington, even Israelis who didn't vote for the Prime Minister had become quite astonished at the level of criticism coming from the White House. Some this week were saying it's changing their opinion of Bibi. On Thursday's edition of The Globalist, we asked what's behind this spat that's increasingly becoming a war of words. Georgina Godwin was joined on the line by Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at UCL.
It's just not what one does. I mean, I think Obama feels not only he's been attacked, but the whole presidency has been attacked. Israel has taken a real chance here. And I think probably Obama and the executive branch think that Israel has to be taught a lesson in that, yes, the United States is devoted to Israel. It was the second to recognize its position as a state. The Soviet Union was the first there. And therefore, the U.S. has often sacrificed its own interests in the region to support Israel, and they don't think Israel really appreciates it. I think a lot of the American officials think that Israel so takes the United States for granted that they can almost do anything, and the U.S. will have to remain in their support. Israel's driven by, obviously, the Israeli government is driven partly by security forms, but also, I think, Obama and the U.S. government thinks it's also driven by an illegitimate desire for a greater Israel, that it does things that just aren't acceptable. And I think Obama has really thought that enough is enough.
Just a very quick question, Kathleen. Is it the administration's criticism of Netanyahu? Might this be a pretext for a long-standing plan to change the U.S. policy of protecting Israel at the UN and in various other international forums?
Well, this has certainly been threatened, hasn't it, that we are going to reassess our support in the United Nations and other international fora. That's also a dangerous approach for the United States. Israel is the only, as they point out, the only real democracy. It is almost like Sparta in the sense that it is so militarized that it's the only real American dependable force in the Middle East, and so the United States has to be careful there. But dumping Israel to any great extent would cause such a ruction in American political elites that Obama has to be very careful here, that he can go so far but no further. I think, obviously, this rage has to die down a bit. Obama is seen as cerebral, as a man who thinks and is careful, but there seems to be, to the outside watcher, a real balance that he has to find in policy between telling Israel, look, this is as far as you can go, and not throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
That was Kathleen Burke from UCL talking to Georgina Godwin on Thursday's edition of The Globalist. Now, we heard earlier our coverage from Tuesday's Monocle Daily as media outlets worldwide were processing the news that an Airbus A320 had crashed in a remote region of the French Alps. By Friday, front pages were flooded with pictures of Andreas Lubitz, the German wing's co-pilot accused of deliberately crashing the plane, killing everyone on board, including himself. Audio from the plane's black box voice recorder suggests Lubitz was alone in the cockpit and intentionally started to descend the plane whilst his pilot colleague was locked out. The stories raised questions of air safety protocols, including those of Lufthansa, the carrier which owns Germanwings. Journalist Imke Henkel has been examining some of the questions that other German journalists have been asking of their own national standards. She joined Tig Enright in the studio on Friday's edition of The Globalist.
People were a bit upset and were unsettled by how quickly actually these pilot was ousted, that German media tend to be far more reluctant actually to show pictures, to name people. They did after a while, some blurred out his face, but after a while, you know, there was of course this photograph that was on the internet and showed him in front of the Golden Gate Bridge. And most German media after a while would print that photo, but German media are far more hesitant actually to show that than, for example, Anglo-Saxon.
And obviously the first lead that I suppose many journalists will follow in these situations is to try and talk to this man's friends or people who knew him. What have the German papers told us about this man and how he interacted with his colleagues, his friends?
That is actually the surprising thing, that they say all his people, and he knew him from when he grew up. He was apparently a very passionate pilot from the start of 14, 16, 18 years on, and trained as a sailing pilot, and they say he was a lovely man. He would never do anything like that. His colleagues seem to think he was outgoing, he had friends, he wasn't weird at all. So nothing like that apparently could be found from what they know.
Then I suppose there are the big questions for Lufthansa, the German flag carrier which owns Germanwings. Unlike some airlines, and it would be wrong to suggest that Lufthansa is the only one, but some airlines have a policy that you never have fewer than two people in the cockpit at any one time. And if there are only two pilots, one goes out for a break or to use a toilet or something like that, someone from the cabin crew comes in and at least sits in the seat. That wasn't their policy.
No, that's right. I understand that isn't a German policy at all. So other than, for example, American, who had a policy that you never are alone there. And it seems quite surprising, and I think no one in Germany really was aware of that. And of course, after the terrorist fears after 9/11, you had all the security regularities that you
had. Which is why the door in the cockpit was locked because of 9/11. But that two people in the cockpit policy, I think, emerged in the United States or developed in the United States after 9/11 as well.
And I think it's quite surprising that it actually wasn't developed in Germany as well.
Because it seems like a fairly simple protocol. We're not talking about having another pilot on board the plane.
Absolutely.
That somebody else just takes a seat when one nips out for a break.
Absolutely, and you can see EasyJet, who actually introduces this policy, I think, from start of today, and so you see it can be
and
done very quickly.
We're seeing a long line of, or a long list, I should say, of other airlines adopting this policy, yet Lufthansa is saying they see no need for it. I think, are they protecting themselves here a little bit?
It sounds like it. It sounds like
because
it.
Because there could be a big lawsuit looming.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it sounds quite surprising. I think everyone who flies this Lufthansa would be far more reassured if they would say, OK, we do that right away. And I'm not quite understanding why they not going for this policy right away, because a lawsuit might follow up.
That was the journalist Imke Henkel there, talking to Tig Enright on Friday's edition of The Globalist here on Monocle 24. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of The Recap. The show was produced by Alice Block and edited by Toby Hammond. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Ben Ryland, thanks for listening. Goodbye.